hi and welcome to the next episode of the Foss North podcast. Today we have Olof with us. So who are you?
Hello. I am Olof Schengren. I am working as an FPGA and embedded designer. Been doing that for 12 years now. I am also very, very involved in open source silicon, which is what we're going to talk about more today. So I'm the co-founder and director of the Fossi Foundation. I am also a member of CHIPS Alliance and a RISC-V ambassador. And apart from the more outreachy parts of my work, I also run some open source silicon projects like the award-winning TUSOC, Idealize, Serve, and Swearwolf would probably be what I'm most known for.
Cool. Yeah, one thing you mentioned before we got started was the difference between open hardware and open source silicon, because you're in the open source silicon business, so to speak.
Yes, that's correct. So open source silicon is often bundled into the open hardware space, but it's a bit different. So open hardware is usually what we, when we talk about PCBs, circuit board designs, we talk about 3D printers and physical things. Open source software, yeah, that's about programming code. Open source silicon is, you could say, it's about microchip design. It's about the tools and the code that goes into making a microchip.
So it's FPGAs, but also ASICs to some extent.
Yes, that's correct. So both FPGA and ASIC. And FPGA is in many ways very similar to software, and ASIC design has parts of it which is very similar to software and parts of it which is very similar to hardware. But this is also why we need to have some special focus on this space, because it's not hardware and it's not software.
Yes, it ends up in between. And I mean, we've touched on open licenses in this series before, but I think the Fossi Foundation does licensing, but you do other stuff as well. So could you tell us a bit more about the whole setup there?
Yeah, so we started Fossi Foundation because we thought there was a need for a vendor-independent body to promote and assist open source silicon within the industry, in academia, and for hobbyists alike. So we formed Fossi Foundation in 2014, and it was unveiled in 2015. So we have a manifesto, and we have some high-reaching goals that we want to fulfill. And one of them was to have places for people to meet, to make sure that there are areas for collaboration where people can work together and come together and share what they know and help new people. One other thing was the technical foundation, and this is both the tools and the code and also licenses, because that was one of the big gaps that we saw, that there existed licenses. Most of them were very much written for software, and when we looked at it close enough, it was not applicable for this domain.
Yeah, I guess the FPGA makes it extra interesting since it's almost software. So
yeah, but then they have like in the GPL license, you have things like static linking. What is static linking when it comes to FPGA, and what is static linking when it comes to ASIC? So it's many things like these. That's common example, but not the only one.
So did you develop any licenses within the Fossi Foundation, or did you basically select licenses that you recommended?
So what we did was that we formed a licensing committee, and then we tried to get on board all the people who were interested in this and all the people who were already looking at this. And this is very much the work we do within Fossi Foundation. We try to bring people together, serve as a place where they can collaborate. So CERN had been looking at open hardware licenses. We had some other people like Andrew Katz had been looking at open hardware licenses. There were some different efforts, and we kind of coordinated a bit within Fossi Foundation, and with the licensing committee tried to keep the key people involved, basically. So last year, there were two very interesting announcements. And the first one was the solder pad license, which has been updated now to cover open source silicon development. The solder pad license is in use by the Pulp ecosystem from ETH Zurich, and also in use in Open Hardware Group, which is a consortium around open source silicon. Solder pad is now under governance of Fossil Foundation. We didn't develop it, but we are governing the standard now. And the other one is from CERN, and it's the version 2 of the CERN OHL licenses. And they have created 3 licenses. This was very much what we wanted to see from Fossil Foundation side. We wanted to see a fully permissive, we wanted to see a weak copyleft, and we wanted to see a strong copyleft license that all worked for chip design. And this is exactly what CERN has done. They created these 3 licenses. I don't remember the exact names of it. It's like dash S and dash L or something like that, but you can look it up. So I think that from that point, we are actually covered. We have a good situation where we can have usable and applicable licenses that work for chip design, which is fantastic.
How do they differ from a software license? Is it mostly that you redefine like how you put things together, so replacing the linking concepts and things like that, or what's the major differences?
So the permissive licenses are very similar, and also I would say I have not been part of this committee myself, so I don't have the exact details, but I have been following the development a bit. So I think that you have things like system libraries, which is a definition in the GPL licenses, and you kind of word that in chip design. You also have the vendors, the chip factories, the fabs that create actual chips. They have something called a PDK, which is a process development kit, and this describes how the actual gates are implemented and what rules apply for spacing between transistors and things like that, deep down the really physical side of things. So these are things that up until last year there were no open PDKs, so you had to rely on a PDK from a ASIC fab. So this would be kind of the equivalent to a system library on the software side. So it's wording that fits the how chips are made better than the software licenses. Also, there's a separate laws around chip design. We have the, I don't know which year it's from, but it's called the Mask Act, I think, which is for when you do an ASIC, you shine some light, and you have a mask which controls which areas of the chip that are the light shines on. And this mask is one of the most proprietary things you will find in chip design. They are extremely expensive, and there are separate laws that handle how things around them. So it's a very specific area.
Another aspect, I guess, that you run into more than software, at least outside of the US, would be patents. Are the permissive licenses like BSD style, where you don't care, or is that something that's sort of handled by these licenses?
That's correct. That's a very important thing. So patents very much apply in a different way, and it's much more important when it comes the closer your hardware you come. And of course, there's the gray zone here when it comes to FPGAs, which is kind of software, and ASICs. So there are different approaches to this, but I think most of the licenses are include patent grants. So, for example, many people use SolarPad, which has a patent grant clause, and also the Apache license is becoming very popular because of this. I'm not exactly sure what it looks like in the CERN licenses.
Well, that's good. That's a topic for another time. We need to talk to Javier again.
Yeah.
I'm thinking here, over the years, I've been in the free software area for so many years, and when talking to my like normal friends that is non-hacker, I have a really hard time explaining what software is, what software development is, and what a free software, open source licenses. I mean, this must be a hell for you.
It is, but there are so many things that are hard to explain about what I do. So,
so can you? What does the kid say? What does daddy do?
He sits by the computer, which is, I mean, my daily routine is very much like programming. So when you develop chips, it's 99% programming. And then in the end, you convert it to a physical thing, but that is often done by someone else. So from my high perspective, I mean, it looks very much like software design, although you have much more expensive and extremely much worse tools to work with. It's like doing software development in the 80s, basically.
Mm. Machine code. when we come to licensing and all of that, I guess a part, sometimes you develop stuff, like you talk about your projects, so you develop these IP blocks or sort of components, but then I guess you do a lot of integration as well when you want to go to a product. So taking UARTs or whatnot and put them together with a CPU core on a piece of silicon. Do you have a good way to handle like the proprietary open boundaries there, or is that a problem? I mean, in some cases, an FPGA comes with hard blocks for certain things, and those must then be considered proprietary software or sort of components at least.
Yeah, so I would say that's a good reason why we have these new licenses, because they need to adapt to this reality. So when we talk about software licenses, I think at least we having a boundary. For example, a library could be a boundary, and in the same equivalent thing in chip development is the IP core. So IP here is for intellectual property, which is it's not a very good name, because it kind of implies that this is something that is named from a business perspective, not from a functional perspective. But it is an IP core is a functional unit, like a UART, like a FFT hardware accelerator or something like that, or a processor, which is also an IP core. So there are, I mean, just like in software, you can have GPL-like or strong copyleft IP cores. These create additional restrictions on their environment that they can often only be used together with other IP cores. Some companies use this as a way to dual license their offerings. They have a proprietary license and have a GPL license or GPL-like license. That would be, for example, one of the new CERN licenses. But I know that when I started out, many people used the LGPL for IP cores, which is not applicable. But the intent was that they wanted people to make modifications to that IP core, but still allow it to exist with proprietary other proprietary cores inside the chip. So some of these new licenses are written to handle that intent, I would say. This is kind of boundary we have.
Weak copyleft license, basically.
Yes.
It's hard for me to understand how all this happens. So can you describe like what you do on a working day, more than just sitting in front of your computer? So how do you develop the hardware? How does it get from your desktop to the factory?
Yeah. So much of my development I do is targeting FPGAs. So what I do is that I write program code in often Verilog, which is one of the main languages for doing digital design. In Verilog, you describe the functionality of what you want the chip to do. And then I either run this in a simulator to see that it behaves as I expected, or I convert this into a binary form, which can be uploaded to the FPGA chip. So an FPGA is a very special type of chip, which is reprogrammable. It's basically, you can see it's a bit of a Lego that you have a lot of building blocks, and you basically describe how these are connected. And in that sense, you can form almost anything as long as you have enough Lego bricks to do it. So this is that would be a normal routine for me to do this.
So you run that. And then you run that through a simulator, so you can see that it all like works. And what happens? How does it become hardware?
Well, when in the FPGA, I would say it never becomes hardware. What you end up with is a configuration file for a specific FPGA device, which tells the FPGA how to form the connections. But it's only software. It's like setting switches in the chip. You fill the memory and in the chip, and you set some switches to control how the signals flow between them. In an ASIC, it would be different. I would still write the same kind of programming code. I would still write Verilog code most often. This time, I would use a tool called a synthesis tool, which convert this to, you can say, graph of more like electrical components such as adders and OR gates and. If you have done any digital design, we'll recognize these, like multiplexers and things like that. So this is still an abstract kind of intermediate representation language, which is called a netlist. It describes the connection between all these logical elements. The next step is to convert these into gates and into transistors, into cells. And at that point, you start to do something. You start to map these into the actual silicon and metal and what you find in the actual chip, and it gets a bit more complicated by that point, but then that is kind of blueprint for how to make the chip, and if you actually build an ASIC, then you will, after that, you will end up with something called a GDS file, which is a file that, just like in if you have done a circuit board, you have these Gerber files, which describes each layer of the PCB. It describes what the copper and the other materials. I'm not very good at PCB design, but like that, you describe how the layers of metal and silicon should be built up, and these form. From that, you create the masks, and then you send it to the fab to do the chip, and it will do a lot of chemistry and physics and very small nanometer things, and you get the chip back.
Okay, cool.
And hopefully it works.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked a bit about building blocks. I mean, one of the projects that you were showing last time I met you was the FuSoC. Like the package manager of IP cores that you're building. Maybe we should dive in there a bit.
Yeah. So it kind of also comes a bit of the collaborative side. So I like collaboration a lot. And there are so much good stuff out there. There has been way too little collaboration. So you have all these IP cores, which exist in isolation. You have... Typically, what you do is kind of that you just copy the source code of each and every IP core into like a giant directory, and then you start building up your chip from that. And that is how we did software long time ago. But it doesn't scale. Nowadays, we use apt or we use other package managers to say, I focus on my top level, and then I just bring in the dependencies. And this is what FuSoC aims to do. It creates a common format for describing IP cores. so that the tools will know what to do with them. It describes the relations, the dependencies between IP cores. So you can build up, just like in software, you can build up a graph of IP cores. And chip design is very hierarchical. So it leans very well towards this kind of methodology. And also...
Yeah, please.
One thing that is also different between software and hardware development or chip design is that in software development, you use, for example, use GCC or LLVM to compile your design. And you use maybe some tools for checking. In the silicon space, we have so many tools. Each FPGA vendor have their own tool flow, which is incompatible with everyone else's. And we have tons of different simulators. We have tons of different tools. So one of my main projects, which is kind of a backend part of USOC, is called Idealize. And that is just an abstraction layer for EDA tools. And it currently, as of yesterday, it has 26 different backends. So it supports now 26 different EDA tools. And this is just, that's also a problem, because before having that kind of abstraction, you can't really collaborate easily, because one group uses one type of simulator, another uses another type of simulator, and when you want to use the other group's cores, you need to rewrite all these configuration files to fit your simulator, which is it's lots of time goes on to these kind of things.
So the actual sort of very long code, the source code is always shareable, but the whole configuration around them is sort of platform specific.
Yeah, much of it is shareable. And just like in software in C, for example, you might be calling some very specific, some features that are specific for this hardware, but generally you just write code that is generally applicable.
Yeah. Does it also generate like some of the interconnections, or do you only get the components and then you have to put them together? Or I mean, if you pull in a component consisting of multiple smaller ones, is it handwritten code, the integration, or can it sort of connect things to a bus and build the whole silicon from you?
That's a very common question, and it doesn't. But there is kind of a plugin structure, something I call generators, which intends to solve that. So that you can have a generator that actually if you describe each of these cores and in the top level describe the connections, you can do this as a sort of plugin, I would say, to FuSoC, but it doesn't exist yet, but that's the way we would handle it. I don't want to add this functionality into FuSoC, because it will make it much harder to maintain and develop the other things.
So basically one tool for that part and one tool for getting the components.
This is all strange.
So my audio dropped out now, I'm sorry.
I'm back. You're back?
Yeah.
So basically two tools, that's the Unix way. That's the way it's meant to be, so to speak.
Yeah.
I remember a discussion we had on a bus for a company I worked with, like 99 something. And I read a notice that perhaps it was Bruce Perens or someone starting something with open hardware. And I remember the discussions then. Yeah, it's cute what you do with free and open source software, but this ain't going to fly when it comes to your hardware. And when hearing your like definition or description of USOC, it's exactly what they thought would never happen. So again, it happened from like a community effort. And it's kind of magic.
Yeah, and there are other things happening right now that last year actually that we have been waiting for 20 years that are super mm-hmm. exciting, and I would love to talk about more.
Is it a secret, or can we do one more episode?
We can do one more episode about
that. Okay, cool.
There's no secrets. Just
and we have a cliffhanger. Yes.
And we have a cliffhanger. Amazing, because we are slowly running out of time. But then we will talk to you next week again. So thank you for this time, and see you around.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye.